Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, just out, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haque.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you, Aziz. And, you know, obviously everybody on the progressive and liberal side, which is actually a majority in this country, if you go back to the election, Hillary Clinton got over 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And some of the statistics now you're seeing about how the Republican Senate, I think, represents something like 140 million Americans, whereas the Democratic Senate, the losers in the Kavanaugh battle, represent something like 180 million Americans. So
right.
There are some structural imbalances in our Constitution, particularly with the Electoral College and the demographic changes underway that will mean by 2040, the Republicans from the red states will control 70 seats in the Senate, whereas the Democrats in the blue states will only have 30 seats in the Senate. And by controlling the Senate, the Republicans will be able to control the court, which is what's been demonstrated in the last few days. So let me start with I want to talk about your book, but I'd like to also talk about your blog at Take Care, that Kavanaugh, because of the risk of impeachment, is going to become even more partisan. And frankly, Aziz, the ceremony that took place yesterday in the White House, which is largely a photo op where he was sworn in for a second time, was so partisan. Trump made the most outrageous partisan remarks, and so did Kavanaugh. So what's your fear here?
The process of confirming now Justice Kavanaugh has created an unprecedented situation in which there is a widely perceived connection between one justice and a particular partisan formation, a particular party, that goes above and beyond a shared ideology. I think any intelligent observer of the courts realizes that there's ideology and ideas and values that matter to judging. But what has happened, in particular, as a consequence of the fight over allegations of sexual abuse against Justice Kavanaugh, is that Justice Kavanaugh's continued tenure in the court, in a very practical way, depends upon continued Republican control of both houses. And why is this? As many people have noted, there are statements that were key to Kavanaugh's defense against Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's allegations that were arguably, probably misleading or false. In particular, his claims about not drinking to the point of blackout are contradicted by a wide number of his college and high school acquaintances. If Justice Kavanaugh misrepresented, if he lied, if he committed perjury under oath in his confirmation hearings, this means that he's at risk of impeachment. And he should know this because the risk of impeachment has precedent in the impeachment of William Clinton at the end of the last millennia for perjury under oath with respect to sexual conduct. Right. So this is this. We know that this is a basis for impeachment because this is the ground that the Republicans used against Clinton. And we also know that impeachment's only going to happen now if Democrats have control over the House and the Senate. So Kavanaugh knows that he is at risk of impeachment if and only if Democrats control the House and the Senate. That means he has a personal and direct interest in the maintenance of Republican control of both houses. This is an unprecedented kind of linkage between a sitting Supreme Court justice and a political party in control of both the House and the Senate. It is, to my mind, something that is utterly inconsistent with democratic values. And because of the power that a Supreme Court justice wields, it is a real threat to democratic competition at the national level.
Well, in your new book, How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, you argue that the sobering reality for the United States is that to a much greater extent than is commonly realized, the Constitution's design to make democratic erosion more, not less likely. Its structural rigidity has had the unforeseen consequence of empowering the Supreme Court to fill in some details, often with doctrines that ultimately facilitate rather than inhibit the infringement of rights. So explain that in the context of what we're talking about with Kavanaugh.
So let me step back as a way of explaining this and give you a couple of sentences of context. What we try and do in How to Save a Constitutional Democracy is to look at how democratic decline has happened in other countries around the world in the last 10 or 15 years, and to try and draw lessons about how vulnerable the United States is, given on what we see overseas. Overseas, we see a consistent pattern of legal and constitutional tools being employed by usually populist parties that have seized political power in order to unravel or limit democratic competition and entrench themselves in power. So one important lesson is that law and constitutions, which are often associated with the promotion of democracy, turn out to be double-edged tools. It's often possible to misuse or to twist around laws and constitutional tools as ways to undermine the force of democracy. And if we look at the suite of tools that are commonly used around the world, which include control of the judiciary, the undermining of opposition parties, the capture of the public sphere, the attacks upon independent elements within government, many, but not all, of those measures are enabled or allowed by the U.S. Constitution. So if we think about the threat to democracy in terms of how that threat has materialized elsewhere, we see that the Constitution does not materially impede that threat.
So you didn't mention freedom of the press being under attack, which it is here in the United States, with the President of the United States referring to the press as the enemy of the American people. Is that to say that the First Amendment is solid, immovable, impenetrable?
No, you're absolutely right to say that, first of all, a variety of kinds of attacks on the press are observed in other countries where you've had democratic backsliding. And at least some of those forms of attack are ways or pathways that are perfectly available in the United States. So, for example, in both Turkey and in Hungary, the populist governments have used regulation. They've used anti-competition laws to squeeze out of business companies that were either that either owned newspapers that printed news that was not dictated or sympathetic to the government, or squeezed out of business companies that provided facilities that opposition politicians relied upon. So an example of that is in Hungary, where the company that owned many of the billboards across Hungary was put out of business by a regulatory measure by the Fidesz government there, with the result that the opposition party can no longer – there is no company that will give the Hungarian opposition space on public billboards to advertise itself. So the only images you see of politicians in Hungary today are images of the ruling Fidesz party and its ruler, Viktor Orbán. Measures like that in the United States, right, the misuse of regulatory powers, for example, by in decisions about whether to allow mergers between different entities, particularly, for example, in the cable and telecommunications business, are very easy to accomplish. There are other measures that are also easy to accomplish. For example, there is no restraint in U.S. law on either verbal attacks of the kind that you described on the press or in outright slander right? So there are a couple of cases in which journalists have been targeted by officials within the White House with false and derogatory information. Right. And if it was a private party that did that, there'd be a remedy under law. But there is no remedy for that kind of targeted picking out of journalists when the perpetrator is a federal government actor. Just because there are some protections under the First Amendment for journalists, and absolutely there are some protections, right, doesn't mean that those protections are complete or robust or cannot be worked around.
Well, there are reports from the White House, from Axios, for example, which is a very, very good insider operation. I think they seem to get the most interesting insight into what's happening. I don't know how Jonathan Swan does it, but he seems to have amazing sources. He was saying the other day that Trump is so thrilled about getting Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the court, and that, after all, is his main achievements, that he's running around sort of gleefully saying, I could get two more. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, you know, getting old, and Sotomayor is, you know, she's a diabetic and she's overweight. Putting aside how grotesque that is, if indeed these reports are true, just in the broader sense, going back to what I said earlier about the demographic changes in the Electoral College will have the effect that the Republicans will, into the future, be able to dominate the Senate and therefore dominate the courts if they haven't already done that.
Right. I think this is a deep problem with the design of the Senate and the U.S. Constitution, that it provides whatever political faction happens to be in the states that are overrepresented when measured on a population baseline, which at the moment tends to be rural, Midwestern and southern states, with a disproportionate amount of political power. And that means that the Senate is always going to be tilted toward, or at least for the foreseeable future, is going to be tilted toward the right in ways that push the court toward the right. And note that that's even true when the president is a Democrat, right? That because the president has to get his or her nominee through the Senate, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. And notice also that the bias that you've described in the Senate's representation doesn't just affect what the Senate itself does, but because the Senate and the measure of how many people are in the Senate is part of the formula that goes to make up the Electoral College, the bias in the Senate also biases the identity of the president away from whoever the popular vote winner is, right? You mentioned that Trump didn't win the popular vote, and the distorted structure of the Senate is part of the reason for that. This, I think, means that the court is going to tend rightward for the foreseeable future. And if I was a progressive politician or reformer, thinking about what to do, particularly about the court, right, and the Senate and the Electoral College are separate problems, right? But if you're just focused on the court, I think that the best strategy is to find ways to limit the court's role in American life, because if we tot up the ways in which the court has contributed over time to progressive causes, right, the sense in which they've aided the underdogs, the people who are marginalized or who are relatively powerless in American society, and you look at, on the other hand, at how many times they help they comfort the comfortable and afflict the afflicted, the second column is much more full than the first column. There's no reason to think that's going to change in the future, and if the court overall ends up being a force for worse rather than for better in national life, and there's no real way of structurally changing that, there are ample ways of reducing the ability of the court to intervene in American public life in ways that are destructive.
And what are they?
A couple of different examples. One is the Constitution says that there has to be a Supreme Court, but doesn't actually say that much about what cases it has to hear. Over history, the court has had very different responsibilities with respect to cases arising in federal courts and in lower federal courts. And it's possible to imagine today that the court's jurisdiction would be dramatically restricted in ways that limit its ability, in particular, to unravel progressive federal statutes. Right, so I'm thinking here of the attacks that the court has mounted, even prior to Justice Kavanaugh's elevation, on statutes like the Affordable Care Act and the Clean Air Act. Right, there are ways of limiting the court's ability to disrupt these progressive programs that take the form of changing its jurisdiction over such cases.
So, do you see then, given the trajectory we're on with a permanent Republican control of the Senate and therefore the courts, does that mean that we have a very narrow window to elect enough Democrats to the Senate to get past a filibuster-proof margin to do certain things? Like, for example, you could make Puerto Rico a state that would pick up two Democratic Senates. You could make Washington, D.C. a state. There are certain short-term fixes that I see, I don't know whether there are any others that you come to your mind, but it seems to me that the challenges are so huge because on the right in this country, you've got the Koch brothers and other powerful plutocrats who are getting behind a constitutional convention, a convention of the states, and they're very close to getting the 2/3 majority of the state legislature signed up.
Absolutely.
And that
yeah, and it's hard to see how a constitutional convention, which is, as you rightly say, largely propelled so far by Koch brothers' money, resulting in any kind of progressive set of changes to the constitution structure of the kind that you identified, right? Adding representation for D.C., for Puerto Rico, altering the population-based the deviation from population-based equality that's represented in the Senate. So I think those things are unlikely. I think that what's more likely to happen as a strategic matter is that the So I think there's two things that are worth bearing in mind that I think complicate the picture. The first is that the nature of the coalition represented by each of the parties changes over time, and it is actually in the last 2 weeks is among the many grotesque things that have happened possible to see the Republican Party becoming an even narrower coalition than it's been, one focused upon a particular ethnic and gender slice of the population, and the Democrats becoming more and more of a broad tent, right? And you can imagine that the changing circumference of the party's narrow or broad tent changes the electoral calculus in some states, right? At least for the purpose of the Senate. So I wouldn't give up on the idea of many states actually being competitive in the near term. It just depends upon the parties. The other thing that's happening is demographics, right? So the baby boomers are increasingly becoming elderly and becoming an increasingly smaller slice of the voting age population. And the voting age population is increasingly made up of people who are in their 20s and 30s who overwhelmingly are, if they don't identify as Democrats, they're committed to many or they've already internalized many ideas of social justice that I think were in a way that was not true 20 or 30 years ago, right? So parties change, demographies change, and those changes have to be accounted for in thinking about the trajectory of the Senate and therefore the courts. And it may be that the easier thing for progressives to do is to alter the scale or the size of their coalitions to attract more young people than to get into the weeds of a fight with the Koch brothers over a constitutional amendment.
Well, Aziz Haque, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No, thank you, Ian, for having me on, and thank you for talking about these really important issues.
And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is a co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, just out, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.